Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Is that the end of this case?
How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Start with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all next.
Welcome to episode 100 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. We might start seeing a summer slowdown, but for now, no such thing. We continue to see cases at various courts. And here, we're celebrating our 100th.
I know we keep saying we're going to have a slowdown, but it hasn't hit yet.
We know the Supreme Court of the United States is done, but other than that, right. And here's to the next 100 episodes. Hard to believe it's already been 100. So in any event, here we go. Our first Indeed. Case today is Muhammad versus Abbott Laboratories, Inc., an Illinois First District case. Our second case today is Tassal versus Carlick, another First District case. And the third case is Miller King, LLC versus Ackerman, a Fifth District case involving contingent fees and replacement counsel. For our first case, an Illinois judicial estoppel case that does not involve undisclosed bankruptcy, which is outstanding and may or may not be unusual, but in any event, that's what we have. In Muhammad versus Abbott Laboratories, Inc., the Illinois Appellate Court, First District, will decide whether the circuit court correctly granted summary judgment on the plaintiff's claim of injury to her child, spina bifida, against the manufacturer of Depakote, is that how you pronounce it? Depakote.
Depakote, yes.
In this case, the plaintiff sued her treating psychiatrist for keeping her on the drug and not prescribing a less toxic drug like lithium when it became clear that she was sexually active but could not manage her birth control. At the time, it was believed that the risk of birth defects was 1% to 2% using Depakote. The first case proceeded to trial, and a plaintiff obtained a $12 million settlement during jury deliberations. Apparently less than the verdict, the jury would have awarded if it had gone to verdict. The plaintiff then sued Abbott, claiming that the drug was mislabeled, as the risk was actually 10 to 17%, and that if this information was known, the doctors would have acted differently. Abbott raised two arguments to that. First, that the plaintiff was judicially estopped, because she had taken the position in the first case that the doctors were the cause of the child's injury, and second, that there was a lack of proximate cause because the doctors testified in the product liability case that they would still have kept her on Depakote. Interesting questions. Number one is the argument at counsel on motions in limine at the medical malpractice trial proper to consider in the judicial estoppel analysis. Number two, does an affidavit by an expert for the plaintiff in response to the motion for summary judgment that the standard of care would have been for the doctors to use the substitute drug create a question of fact under the heeding presumption? Heeding as in H-E-E-D, not heeding, which it sounds like at times if you listen to the oral argument. Pat, tell us about oral arguments here, including proximate cause.
Thanks, Dan. And so we've talked about judicial estoppel a couple times on the show, but just to refresh, this is a situation where a party takes one position in prior litigation, a factual position, usually, gains a benefit, and then takes an opposite position in subsequent litigation. So in this case, there's not really a question that they got a benefit, $12 million. The question is, did they take an inconsistent position in this case than the one that they're taking in the prior case? That's the issue on the judicial estoppel question. And the trial court granted summary judgment on the judicial estoppel, did not reach the causation question, which we will talk about, and which the court, they spent about half the time in the oral argument about it. It's just really complex. And frankly, the judicial estoppel argument is really complex because it gets into a very strange interaction between medical malpractice cases and product liability cases. And it comes up both in the judicial estoppel context as well as in the causation context, because there's different defenses and different ways that you deal with these cases, because they're just different kinds of cases. Medical malpractice is an extraordinarily specific kind of tort practice. It is very much its own thing. Likewise, so is product liability, a much broader topic to be sure, but it also is a very narrow and has its own thing. And so trying to figure out how these two fit together, because you found yourself in a lot of these, a lot of the cases the parties, or particularly the plaintiff, was relying on are med mal cases and not products cases. And the defendants are saying, hold it, this is a products case, not a med mal case. So a couple extra facts. Apparently, originally, when they sued, they did sue Abbott and then dismissed Abbott and then said, you know, we're not going to go against Abbott. And then at the trial, they said, hey, we're not going to go against Abbott again. And here we are years later. This apparently, this injury, this birth occurred in 2005. It's now 2022. And now it's unclear when the trial took place in the first case, but many years ago, apparently. And so now they're coming back against Abbott. Well, how can you do that? You said you weren't going to do it, and now you've done it. They also took the position on some motions in limine, in particular on what they were going to add, what they didn't want the doctor or the jury to hear about what the doctors would have done given certain, you know, with regards to this drug. So it's a very interesting case in that regard, with how these different doctrines fit together. And the where it really gets interesting. And so one of the arguments that the plaintiffs are using, or the defendants are using, is this oral argument at the motion in limine stage. Yeah. And the plaintiff comes back and says, hold it, you didn't get the result. You just got the argument. You didn't actually see what happened at the trial, what evidence actually got introduced. They didn't give you any of that. And if they had, you would have seen that this actually didn't happen. I don't know. We'll see. Well, let's go to the causation argument. The causation argument essentially is the doctors testified in the product liability case in 2020, even if they had known that it was 100% that it was going to cause a birth injury, they still would have kept her on the Depakote. And the plaintiff's attorney, I think quite rightly, said that's an absurd statement by the doctor. Yeah, it seems a pretty incredible testimony. Why he would give it, I don't know. The argument he makes is, hold it, what really is, what the standard really is that what's called the heeding presumption, is that there's a presumption that a doctor would, if given a proper warning, would have heeded that warning and followed it as part of the standard of care. And what the defendant comes back and says, hold it, that presumption's never been adopted in Illinois. Yes, there's an Illinois case on it, but it's interpreting Texas law, citing a Colorado case. In other words, right, not Illinois law. Crazy set of facts, whatever case that is. But moreover, that this is not a standard of care case. This is a case about causation. And hey, it's not my fault the doctor testified the way that he did. The doctor said he would have kept the woman on the Depakote. And this is apparently after they testified they didn't remember what they did or anything. And then all of a sudden they say they wouldn't have taken her off the Depakote. A tragic situation to be sure. And another interesting issue is they got the $12 million. They was settled during jury deliberations, apparently. Somehow the jury ultimately reached its verdict. Maybe they had a high-low type situation. The settlement negotiation was, so no less than $5 million, no more than $12 million, and apparently the jury came back with some number of above $12 million, which would explain why the jury entered its verdict, and then they just took the high end of that number. The parties, Dan, talked about Abbott being able to get a set-off for the $12 million. Now, set-offs usually apply in good faith findings under the Joint Tortfeasor Contribution Act. This is not a contribution case. I don't understand. I mean, I think they are entitled to the $12 million set-off, but I'm not sure I understand what the procedural basis is for them to get it. I think it makes sense that they get it. I just don't know how they get it.
I don't either. It was a bit confusing.
Yeah, but in any event, so the jury at the trial, let's suppose this gets reversed and it goes back to trial, or goes back to the trial court and the case gets tried. The jury won't hear about the $12 million. They won't hear about the first case. They won't hear about any of that. They'll just hear what Abbott did or didn't do, knew or didn't know, this kind of a thing. And then at the end, if the jury enters a verdict, you know, let's suppose the jury enters a verdict of $20 million, then Abbott would get a $12 million credit and only be on the hook for $8 million. Likewise, if the jury enters a verdict for $10 million, then there would end up being no award in favor of the plaintiff. But it'll be interesting to see how that works. And that played in because it deals with the fairness issue. Because remember, in this judicial estoppel situation, you have to look at whether it's fair. And the argument of the plaintiff is, hold it, we didn't get a full recovery. We got a partial recovery according to the finding of the first jury. So, Dan, anything else to add on this really very interesting and complex case?
It is a very interesting case, and it's kind of the intersection of the two things we were talking about, product liability and medical malpractice. So, you know, there's like a Venn diagram here. There probably are some in the kind of the med-mel arena, right, that have kind of that subspecialty of the product liability piece versus bad procedures or whatever. So very interesting intersection in those two very complex arenas.
There's a lot of case. There's some cases that talk about, you know, where you have this intersection. You know, in one of the cases came up, it's a case involving Baxter, where you have medical devices and medical malpractice at the same. So this comes up a fair amount, but the law is different in various respects in these two areas. So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with Tsai versus Kulik. We're back for segment two of episode 100 of the Podium and Panel podcast, and we're discussing our second case, Tsai versus Karlik. Sorry, I mispronounced it on our way out of the last break. It's Karlik, K-A-R-L-I-K, kind of like garlic, I guess. Is there a third way to get attorney's fees under Illinois law? That is, in addition to a statute and contract, is there an equitable exception premised on the common fund doctrine that allows a plaintiff to obtain fees where the conduct of the defendant is sufficiently egregious? That is the question to be addressed when the Illinois Appellate Court First District decides Tsai versus Karlik. The plaintiff alleged oppressive and illegal conduct by the defendants in the management of an LLC and claimed 45 separate acts of such conduct. Those were identified by the trial judge in a very extensive opinion that apparently ran into the many dozens of pages, which is very unusual for a trial court opinion in at least Illinois state court, for an opinion to run into the many dozens of pages. They just don't have the time. They got too many cases to write opinions like that. The trial court awarded fees to the plaintiff to make them whole for having to litigate the issues and to make the LLC whole. The defendants contended that in the absence of a statute or contract, Illinois courts strictly follow the American rule, and attorney's fees are not allowed. There are a myriad of other issues, including whether the Illinois version of the Uniform Limited Liability Company Act might allow recovery of fees. Dan, tell us about the oral argument in this rather interesting matter.
Thanks, Pat. And one thing that I think is going to be interesting here is that our friend Justice Jerry, not Jerry, Terry Lavin.
Terry.
His brother Jerry that I had for class. Terry Lavin was not present. His dog was being put down. And so it would have been interesting if he were here at oral arguments, being a former plaintiff's lawyer. I kept thinking that throughout these arguments, boy, the dynamics would have been much different here if he were here. And this,
I would have been very interested, right, to hear his, right, thoughts.
And we'll find them out, because he's going to listen to the case and we'll weigh in. As you mentioned, there's a few ways that you can get attorney's fees, and Illinois and most other places, right? The American rule, for those that aren't familiar, is that people pay their own way for legal fees and litigation, even if you're the prevailing party. And then there is a statutory... So what Illinois law generally says is that either there has to be a specific statute that specifically shifts the fees, and we've talked about some of those, some of these alphabet soups of statutory offenses, like BIPA, for example, is one that's a definitive shift of fees, or by contract. You can have a shift of fees by contract, and oftentimes you see that in contracts between parties. In this case, as you mentioned, Pat, this is a not atypical, probably not completely uncommon situation we have here, where people that are part of an LLC, the people that are managing the LLC, whether it's the majority, sometimes they're 50-50, it wasn't quite clear here what the split was, but you have the managers of the LLC committing acts that the other party alleges were not consistent with the way that things should be done. And in this case, as you mentioned, 45 allegations and specific acts that were alleged to have been violative of fraud and other types of provisions. Now, the appellant talked about what was the reversal of the fee shifting award. As you mentioned, the trial court did award attorney's fees based on the common fund, and then looked at the common fund doctrine and said that when something was egregious, as is here, you could in fact shift. The defendants here, the counsel, mentioned that this was merely a legal question as to the propriety of that interpretation under the common fund and the statute, whether or not you could in fact shift the fees as was done here. And one of the arguments made by the defendants in this case is that the defendants, as part of the underlying action, the Limited Liability Company Act of Illinois and many other state, these uniform provisions, what they do is that they, one thing that's a possibility in egregious situations like this is that they have to disgorge their membership units. And in this case, the defendant's advocate argued very strenuously that there was, in fact, a remedy here. The egregious conduct was addressed because these defendants collectively own 53% of the LLC, and they disgorged their membership units, which was not insignificant because this LLC had assets to the tune of $4 million. So that's a two.
That was disputed, of course.
But that was the...
Or the contention was made that it wasn't in the record, the value of the business. So, yeah.
That's the argument here. And they talked about a number of cases. One was there's this case that the defendant used pretty frequently, the Morris case. That advocate said that was the definitive case on fee shifting and common funds. They argued that the trial court had not used that case once. When the plaintiff's counsel got up and talked about Morris, the advocate distinguished Morris. And the reason for that was, again, that this case, as you mentioned, a very detailed opinion and findings of why attorney's fees in this case were used to make the plaintiffs whole. And they said that in Morris, there wasn't the egregious conduct and kind of the overall overarching issues that existed in this case. There's also another case called Linger that the defendants said was subsequent to Morris. And so there's a big argument about these cases in Illinois that have been applied in terms of this whole issue of the common fund and whether or not you could use that to, again, shift fees to make the plaintiffs whole. And the argument, you know, in all these cases, Pat, as we know, situations like these types of situations, if attorney's fees are awarded to plaintiffs, counsel, such as was done here, then the argument is that the victims of whatever the conduct was in these situations isn't made whole. And again, the defendant's counsel made the argument, I think, pretty strongly and convincingly to some extent, that that's the case in any situation, right? If someone's injured, a plaintiff's injured in a workers' comp injury, or you're injured a personal injury, negligent death, whatever it is, the plaintiff's counsel in those cases is getting a contingency fee, and so the victim's never really made whole in any of these situations. But I think it'll be interesting to see.
Where does the rule stop? What's the limiting principle? Is really the question is, okay, these guys were really bad. The court found them to be really bad. They say they weren't so bad, but okay. And apparently the first appeal of this case, the appellate court found that they didn't have malicious intent. Okay, so they did a lot of really bad things, but they didn't intend to do it. Okay, put that aside. The other thing that was interesting is that they argued they had other avenues to get the fees. Namely, there was one claim about discovery abuses. Says, well, why didn't you file a 219C motion? You know, you can get recovery under Supreme Court Rule 219C if someone's really bad in their discovery practice. There's other places to get fees that don't involve the creation of this equitable doctrine to get fees. I will point out that the disgorgement remedy that Dan mentioned is an equitable remedy. It's not a legal remedy. And it's important to remember where this equity and law thing comes from. These are two different, at common law, there were two different courts that grew up in two different ways. One awarded money, one did justice, and sometimes a judge, they wore different hats. One was in the king's court, that's the chancery. The other is the law courts. Those are, as the name suggests, the law courts. They do different things. And you typically can't get a mixture of those remedies. You get one or the other. Cook County, we have a chancery division. Now those judges can and do hear legal claims and hear claims that have a jury. Typically you can't get a jury in equitable claims. That's something for a judge to decide. So these are very different kinds of claims, and the difference in these claims goes back centuries, and comes to us in that way. It's been modernized, and the lines have been blurred, but this seems to be a blurring that's a lot of blurring. if it stands, they're gonna have to make a bright line.
You know what? The plaintiffs' counsel they closed with the statement that if ever a case warranted fee shifting, it is this. And again, like you said, the initial time this was on appeal found no malicious intent. So it's unclear again, you know, what the full extent of the alleged misconduct was and why plaintiffs in this case think this is more egregious than any other case, that this should set precedent. But as we've talked about, and like you said, it's a slippery slope. And once you open this door, then you know, I think it'd be interesting if they go that route, that we would see, you know, like you said, a third way to recover attorney's fees.
We will see. So with that, we'll take our next break and come back with our third segment on episode 100.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment 3 of episode 100 of the Podium and Panel Podcast, and we're going to cover Miller King. In this case, what is the appropriate manner to allocate attorney's fees for a discharge?
That's not a beer.
It's not. Miller King is not a beer. What is the appropriate manner to allocate attorney's fees for a discharged attorney who was working on a contingency fee? And what discovery is the discharged attorney permitted to obtain about the activities of subsequent counsel in order to present his case? Those are the questions to be addressed when the Illinois Appellate Court, 5th District, decides Miller King LLC versus Ackerman. Ackerman was hired to represent a client in a personal injury case, but when after 11 months, progress was made on a case, according to at least the plaintiff, he was fired and Miller King was retained. About a year later, the case was settled short of suit being filed. And then a dispute arose about the allocation of attorney's fees. And Ackerman was awarded quantum merit of $500 per hour for 22 and a half hours of work, or $11,250. According to the argument, that represented 1.6% of the settlement amount, which would put the settlement amount at just over $700,000. Ackerman was precluded from obtaining the discovery, any information about the activities of subsequent counsel, and then he was precluded from asking about that at trial as well. The trial court focused exclusively on the activities of Ackerman, his skill and experience at arriving at the hourly rate to be charged, and the number of hours he worked on the matter. Pat, tell us about oral argument in this case.
So oral argument began with, we're not going to say what the settlement amount was because it was confidential. And then they proceeded to give the math, that the numbers that if you did the math, you could figure out how much the settlement was. So that's where the $700,000 came from. Now, I'm not known for my maths being very strong, but I think I can do this one. And so, yeah, thanks, fellas, for keeping that confidential. Now, we don't know who the defendant is, of course, but you get the idea. So $700,000, a third the third of that is just short of $250,000. So the initial lawyer got $11,000 out of just a little bit less than $250,000 or thereabouts. So, you know, you get the idea. It is also important to note that the subsequent firm associated with another firm, a firm up here, the Whiting firm from up here in Chicago, to assist them in handling the matter and to get the case resolved. But the case didn't have to be tried in order to get resolved. In fact, we don't know what they did to get it resolved. We just know they resolved it. And neither does the plaintiff, the lawyer, know how it got resolved. One other thing as a opening matter is this was filed as an equitable claim for adjudication of the lien. So you had the two competing attorneys' liens, perhaps three, if the Whiting firm also asserted a lien, which I imagine they did, but they weren't in the caption. So you have the Miller King lien, you've got the Ackerman lien, and you've got to figure out how to deal with these liens. And the usual rule in Illinois is that when on a contingency fee agreement, when a lawyer is discharged, that he can get quantum merit. And quantum merit is the idea that you get whatever, you know, the value of the services you provided, which is usually done by the number of hours you worked multiplied by a reasonable fee. And the court here set the fee for a lawyer with Ackerman's experience and the difficulty of the matter at $500 an hour. And then Ackerman would have had to produce some sort of way to show how many hours he worked. You know, I bill my hours, Dan bills their hours. Oftentimes plaintiff's attorneys don't bill their hours. But when this kind of a situation arises, they really can't put forward how many hours they spent. I know some plaintiff's attorneys do bill their hours, maybe not on the tenths of the hour the way we do.
They keep track of the hours, maybe. But most plaintiffs' lawyers just don't because it doesn't come up. Right?
There's no reason. Yeah, it doesn't come up. You know, they're not expecting to get fired. So and if the client leaves, they're sayonara. Right. I don't want to deal with you anymore. And they oftentimes will waive their lien. But in this case, given its value, this lawyer didn't want to waive his lien. And so the general view is if that's the case, who cares what the subsequent lawyer did. It doesn't matter. But I will say that Ackerman's advocate raised a very good point. What if all the subsequent lawyer did was write a demand letter? And the defendant said, you got us. We'll pay the money. What, you know, I don't know what they did. The council didn't decide. It's a hypothetical. I don't know what they did, but let's suppose that's all they did. Why do they deserve $250,000 for that? And I only get $11,000. They didn't try the, they say, I didn't try the case. I didn't answer discovery. I didn't. Well, neither did they. They didn't, you know, so what magic, what was in the magic sauce that got them the settlement? Now there are cases that talk about an exception in this situation where if the first lawyer gets fired and the case gets settled shortly thereafter, that you can get a contingency fee arrangement because essentially the case was on the eve of settlement. Now this is plainly not what happened here. That they weren't on the eve of settlement. They didn't even claim that they were on the eve of settlement. And as evidenced by the fact that, you know, the case doesn't get settled for 10 or 12 months thereafter. The other thing that was interesting, and it's a point well taken by counsel for Miller King, is, hold it, just because that's when the case got settled doesn't mean that's when our representation ended. There were still liens to negotiate. There were other things to do. You know, medical liens, presumably things of this nature they had to deal with, perhaps Medicare. I don't know. There's other things for a plaintiff's lawyer to do after they settle the case other than collect the check and distribute it. They do have to, I presume, again, that there were liens of some kind that needed, whether they were healthcare liens or medical liens or, you know, healthcare insurance liens, I mean, or medical liens or Medicare, who knows? They had something, I imagine, they needed to do. But none of that was disclosed. And the question is, why, you know, is that proper? And then on top of that, then at the trial, he doesn't get to ask, you know, what did you do? The judge said, no, you don't get to know about any of that stuff. You don't, you know. And then one of the justices asked, well, what about an offer of proof? He says, an offer of proof of what? I didn't get the information. What was I going to do an offer of proof on? It's like, that kind of makes sense. How was he supposed to do an offer of proof if he didn't even know he didn't have the discovery on the issue in the first instance? But it seems that the rule in Illinois is generally you don't get this kind of information because it's not relevant to what the discharge lawyer did, because it's what the discharge lawyer did, not what the subsequent lawyer did that matters. Anything else to add on this one, Dan?
I think it'll be interesting to see how it comes out.
It will be. I will say there's a bit of schadenfreude as a defense lawyer watching plaintiff's lawyers argue about their fees. I do enjoy that. I've posted about that in the past. As you know, I imagine plaintiff's lawyers get some schadenfreude as well when insurance companies fight over fees, which happens a good deal too. So yes, we do enjoy when the other side is fighting over getting paid or not having to pay in the case of insurance companies. Which brings us to our segment on business interruption and COVID cases. Dan, you want to tell us what happened this week in business interruption and COVID cases?
Yeah, the COVID-19 decisions at appellate level continue to be consistently for insurers. I was quoted last week in the Law 360 about, you know, just the uniformity and probably like you, Pat, we've talked about this. Probably no other area I can think of where it was this consistent, you know, across the board. And there may be some outliers, but it just has been universally for insurers. Last week, the Supreme Court of South Carolina heard arguments on, I think it was 7 certified questions. And the other thing that happened was in the Goodwill case, they filed a petition for cert with the Supreme Court of the United States. As we talked about before on the case with the dirt in the streets in New Orleans and other insurance cases, the Supreme Court of the United States is not going to get involved in business interruption or any other coverage disputes. It's a state issue. The argument of Goodwill was that federal courts are not taking enough heed or doing enough certification to state courts for answers. And again, the 7th Circuit, 2nd Circuit, and others that have rejected the request for certification have said, look, we can interpret this stuff and it doesn't matter, right? Because we can look at the allegations, we can look at the exclusions and all the other stuff, and we don't need to, we can pretty successfully predict what it is that the states would do. And
so far they've been right.
And Massachusetts and a couple other states, you know, have Iowa have done this, and there's a couple other states pending, but again, just a note, and our prediction sure to go wrong. There's a couple of COVID cases as well.
Well, why don't we go to those now? We are 146, or Dan is 146 and a half, 25 and a half, and 7. I am 145 and a half, 26 and a half, and 7. The two we got right this week were kind of layups because they're both COVID-19 cases from the Seventh Circuit. Windy City versus Cincinnati and Melcorp versus West American. Windy City dealt with a situation, deals with a limousine company here in Chicago that has a whole fleet of both limousines, buses, party buses, a whole range of things. And the court said, no, you don't get business interruption for this. And, oh, by the way, you can't look at the definition of property damage in the unique argument there was the plaintiff made that you can look at the definition of property damage in the liability portion of the CGL policy to find out that they're to create an ambiguity. The court said, no, that's for a different purpose. That doesn't work. Dan, do you want to tell us about Melcorp and the great potato?
Where am I here? Why don't you tell us? Yeah.
So Melcorp dealt with the mall. It's a mall food court business, and they got shut down. And essentially, the court this is more straightforward. It's just like it's just not physical damage to your property. You got shut down because of the orders. Too bad. No coverage. And now we come to Padgett versus Norfolk Southern, which we got wrong. This is the case where they sued Norfolk Southern, not the operating entity, Norfolk Southern Railway Company. And let's just say the Seventh Circuit is not happy with the lawyers and not happy with the district court judge because none of them fixed the caption. And essentially the argument is Norfolk Southern Railway comes into this case, litigates the case, even though they weren't sued, never gets the problem corrected, essentially moves for summary judgment, and non-parties can't move for summary judgment. The order is vacated and it sends it back to do it again. I'm not sure what's going to change on other than the name the right party, but the court was just really annoyed. We've all had this situation, Dan, as defense lawyers, where they name the wrong party and you get it corrected. You call them up and you say, you got to name the right party. If they won't name the right party, you move to dismiss. And they didn't do this here. They tried to answer, incorrectly sued this and that. And the court just wasn't happy at it. Wasn't having any of it. And it's a non-precedential decision, but it does tell you where the court's at.
One place where that has not worked, Pat, is back when I worked at CNA Financial. Oftentimes CNA Insurance would be named. There is no CNA Insurance company. And some judges around the country, even in Illinois, would say, that's the banner you go under. So too bad for you, which is bizarre, but there are situations like that. But yeah, that's like you said, normally you fix it, you get the right party and it works. Like you said, I don't know what it's going to be different when this goes back, but we'll see.
Yeah. At least on the merits, they just weren't happy with the procedure, which brings us to our, predictions for this week, Muhammad versus Abbott. What do you think? It's rather esoteric.
I
don't either. I'm going to say affirmed.
I was going to say affirmed too. I think it gets affirmed. But yeah, it's so esoteric. Who knows?
Cy versus Karlik. I don't know how this stands. I don't know. I don't know enough about the case to see if there's other ways around it. Maybe they find it through the LLC. We'll say this. This is the prediction, at least for me. They are not going to find that there's an equitable exception. They may find there's another way for them to get these fees, but it isn't through equity.
I agree. And again, it's a wild card because Justice Lavin was not, we didn't get his, if we would know where he was for sure. The other two.
Yeah.
Right.
Bad poker player.
Right.
Judge Lavin. And Miller King versus Ackerman. That's affirmed. Yeah. Which brings us to our rule of the week, which is something we haven't talked about much recently. And that's standing in the Seventh Circuit. It is appropriate that on the 100th episode, we do talk about standing because we've talked about it on, I think, episode as early as episode 2 we've talked about this issue. And we finally have the split in the Seventh Circuit amongst the judges as to where they stand on what constitutes a tangible, concrete injury for the purposes of Article III standing. We now know that there are seven who say emotional damages are not enough, and there are four who say that they are. And this is comes to us from a denial, a dissent from a denial of hearing en banc written by Judge Hamilton, joined by Judges Wood, Rovner, and Jackson Akinwumi. I got that right? Okay, and then the seven other judges, they didn't write it. Judge Sykes basically says a majority of the opinion, and she's in the majority, a majority of the judges deny the hearing en banc, but here's this 19-page dissent from Judge Hamilton, which, though I wish I didn't, it's very well reasoned. I think he might be right. He opens with, "I respectfully dissent from the denial of the rehearing en banc. This case presents an important question to the extent of Congress's power under the Constitution to regulate interstate commerce, its power to authorize private civil remedies for statutory violations that cause intangible but concrete injuries, including emotional distress, fear, and confusion." So a couple things that make up the rule. First is Article III standing, important issue. The second thing is you're hearing things en banc. And the third thing is, why write the dissent, Dan? Tell us about why Judge Hamilton is writing this dissent.
Well, I think in large part he's writing this dissent because this is something we've covered on extensively. And again, on these alphabet soups of cases, you have that seems to be the main injury, right? We've talked about this in BIPA, FCRA. All the things that, of course, Easterbrook, the alphabet soup of where generalists don't call them. Right. But it seems to be, if that is, in fact, the position of the seven, it's an interesting kind of dynamic, I think, as we kind of try to address these matters.
Well, I think there's a split, circuit split, between at least the seventh and the third. And perhaps others. The Seventh Circuit has taken this extreme view. This is not a situation where they're simply saying the statutory damages are enough. They're saying that this is a person who got a dunning letter, if I remember correctly, and it's on a dead debt. They're trying to revive a dead debt, and the debt cannot be revived, and she knew it couldn't be revived. She told them it couldn't be revived, but notwithstanding, she was very worried, and there was a trial, and she got the class was awarded $350,000, and that was reversed, saying that there was no injury. So this it helps get the case a PLA granted. If you've got it reads it like does. A PLA. I'm a sorry, PLA. A petition for writ of certiorari. It reads like a petition for writ of certiorari written by a circuit judge joined by three of his colleagues to say, you know, the Supreme Court's got to deal with this because this doesn't seem right to us. Please answer this. And the way you read it is the reason I read that is because if you remember Justice Thomas's view in a recent opinion where he said, this is the thing that Congress gets to do. And he's joined with the four liberals at that time, on the issue. He was in the minority on that one. I'm sorry. He was in the minority. He joined the three liberals. It was after Ginsburg had passed. But he joined the three liberals to say, no, Congress gets to do this. This is in the TransUnion case. He dissented. And this is written for Justice Thomas. Because I think they just want to get it taken. Because if you can get Justice Thomas and the three liberals, then you can get the case taken and resolve this split. I don't think it's going to work out. He's going to have to peel off one of the conservatives in order to prevail. But at least you know that that's who this is written for. That's what this is going on here. So we'll see what happens. We'll see if this Midland case or another case like it. This comes from Pierre versus Midland Credit Management. This is not the last we've heard of it. There will at least be a petition for writ of certiorari. It may get heard by the court. Yeah. We'll see. They've got a lot of open docket space.
They've only granted for next term about 20 cases. And so They got 40 plus left in the arsenal. So
yeah, there's a lot of docket space. Maybe they could fill it up with this one. So with that, thank you everybody for joining us. This is for our first 100 episodes. Have a great week.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the podium and panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.